Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane. This week in Oregon, Jackson County voters approved a local tax on the sale of recreational marijuana. Dozens of other Oregon municipalities have passed similar measures in advance of legalization in July. Jackson County Commissioner Doug Bridenthal says it's a matter of coping with expected increases in law enforcement costs.
Who should be paying for the influx of this new product into the judicial system? Should it be the property owners or should it be the users?
The new legalization law passed by Oregon voters last fall says that, as with alcohol, only the state can tax cannabis. Liam Moriarty explores the issue in just a few minutes. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. The marijuana legalization measure Oregon voters passed last November says only the state can tax recreational cannabis. 20% of that state tax revenue is earmarked for cities and counties. But a lot of local governments around the state say they need a bigger slice of that pie. Jackson County residents gave their approval this week to a measure to add a county tax on production and sales of both medical and recreational pot. Liam Moriarty explains.
Doug Bridenthal says legal marijuana in Oregon will result in a wave of new costs that Jackson County will have to shoulder. He says officials in Colorado, the first state to have a legalized market for marijuana, back him up.
Some of these counties, like Denver County, Colorado specifically, the number I got was it's actually increased their driving under the influence of marijuana by 50%.
He predicts child abuse and domestic violence cases will rise as well. Bridenthal is chair of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. He was one of two commissioners who voted in November to put the tax measure on a special ballot in March. Taxing marijuana, he says, is a matter of fairness to Jackson County property taxpayers.
Who should be paying for the influx of this new product into the judicial system? Should it be the property owners or should it be the users?
Measure 91, the legalization law passed by Oregon voters last fall, says that, as with alcohol, only the state can tax cannabis. That hasn't stopped at least 70 Oregon cities from passing local pot taxes. The League of Oregon Cities is vigorously pushing a bill in Salem that would give cities taxing authority and other controls over cannabis sales that Measure 91 does not. At a recent legislative hearing in Salem, the League's Scott Winkles told lawmakers the estimated portion of the state's pot tax earmarked for cities is inadequate.
Law enforcement costs, staff planning time, legal time, it will add up. $2 million split among 242 cities simply doesn't pay the bills for this.
But Anthony Johnson, chief petitioner for Measure 91, says freeing local governments to assess their own taxes on cannabis would undermine the cornerstone of the measure.
If you're going to curtail the illicit underground market, which everyone wants to do, having local taxes really defeats the purpose and will defeat the entire priority of Measure 91 to bring people out of the unregulated market into the regulated market.
Johnson points to problems in Washington state, where legal marijuana is heavily taxed, forcing prices up.
And then you have illegal dealers standing outside in the parking lot, undercutting the price of the regulated stores.
He counsels a wait-and-see approach to modifying the measure that passed 56-44%.
Let the voters' will be implemented, and then changes can be made if necessary down the line.
State Representative Peter Buckley agrees. The Democrat from Ashland says legislators may be open to adjusting the formula for distributing state pot tax revenue to send more to local governments. But he says similar concerns about increased costs were raised last session in opposition to his bill that established a statewide dispensary system for medical marijuana. He says those fears haven't been borne out.
There are now 200 medical marijuana dispensaries roughly operating around the state. So far, there has not been a single crime associated with any of the dispensaries.
Buckley says studies in Colorado have similar findings.
In fact, violent crime is actually down in Colorado And the last report I saw was that auto fatalities are also down.
Jackson County Commissioner Doug Bridenthal notes that the county tax on sales of marijuana allows the commissioners to set the tax rate up to 25%. He says it could be lower.
And that way, if we don't have these impacts, we can just put it at zero.
Bridenthal adds that that would be his preference, but that he can't guarantee the rest of the board would agree to forgo the tax revenue if the measure is approved by voters. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
The first government-run recreational marijuana shop in the country opened this past weekend in Washington State. Revenues from the pot shop will benefit the small town of North Bonneville. Community leaders there say their town could really use the cash. The economy in that part of the state has been slow to recover since the timber industry collapsed more than two decades ago. Conrad Wilson reports.
North Bonneville, Washington is deep in the Columbia River Gorge.
There is one gas station, there is one restaurant, there is a golf course, and there is the Bonneville Hot Springs Hotel.
John Spencer is the former city administrator turned consultant, and with a few exceptions, he's just described most of the town's economy. A few years ago, the town of about 1,000 people stopped watering parks and other public places to save money. And a few months ago, it started turning off streetlights to cut down on its electricity bill.
The city is on its knees financially. They have run negative numbers in the general fund multiple months in a row because they have no retail sector here. And in Washington State, you're dependent on a retail sector because of the sales tax. And this store could very well make a town that is otherwise going to fail.
The store Spencer's talking about is the Cannabis Corner, North Bonneville's first retail marijuana store. And in fact, it's the first recreational pot shop in the country run by a government. So is it a city-owned pot shop?
No, absolutely not. This is a public development authority pot shop, a municipally operated pot shop.
Spencer says it's common for cities to create public development authorities when they want to do something in the private sector, as sort of a municipal corporation. Convention centers are a pretty typical example.
In the headlines, everybody wants to say it's a city-owned pot shop, which I guess I leave that for lawyers. I guess technically, in some level, it is.
That's North Bonneville Mayor Don Stevens, who embraces the title of the Marijuana Mayor, right down to the personalized license plates he's ordered for his car that read MJ Mayor. He says the city pursued the idea of a marijuana store because it gives it more control over how it's operated.
Whereas if a private person came in and opened a store and it wasn't working out in the community's best interest, we'd have a really long, ugly path to try and, you know, straighten that situation out.
Under Washington State's pot law, cities don't get any revenue from pot taxes. The money goes to the state. Critics of that model say it slowed the industry's growth. Some cities have implemented moratoriums, in part because they fear they'll incur costs without getting any of the revenues. While North Bonneville's new store will still pay taxes to the state, the pot shop's profits will go back into the community by partnering with the city on projects.
While it can't just deposit its profits directly into our general fund, can, as a separate corporation, help us defray costs with law enforcement contracts, public health and safety programs, any number of things that will ultimately have a positive effect on our bottom line.
Right now, the city runs on 7 staffers and an annual budget of $1.2 million. Officials predict the Cannabis Corner will bring in $225,000 in profits this year. They're hoping for up to $500,000 next year. Casey Rader is the executive director of the Skamania County Chamber of Commerce. She says the region's economy has been slow to rebound after the timber industry collapsed in the early 1990s.
Tourism is our main industry now.
Rader says by adding reasons for people to visit, she's hoping it'll help the region's economy grow.
Perhaps somebody's coming out to go hiking. They're going to hike Beacon Rock. They may stop at the cannabis store. But they also look at the lifestyle that we have, the beauty that we have, the proximity to the greater Portland area and to the airport. They might bring their business here. And that is just, you know, the multiplier of what tourism can do for us.
As word of North Bonneville's government-run pot shop spreads and the state's marijuana industry grows, officials expect more cities may try to get into the business. I'm Conrad Wilson in North Bonneville, Washington.
Privacy is a concern for a lot of people in the digital age. For someone fleeing domestic violence, it can be a matter of life or death. Many victims of domestic violence also wind up homeless. A policy intended to protect their privacy has left Washington State with less money to help the homeless. John Ryan looks at the tension between privacy and charity.
When a homeless person needs help, they're probably going to have to give over a lot of personal information to get it.
What is your monthly income before taxes? $650?
We always have to assess for safety. Are you homeless due to a situation of domestic violence?
Those are operators at Seattle's Crisis Center. They were fielding requests for housing assistance on the 211 helpline. In Washington State, homeless people are given the choice to let their personally identifying information stay out of the big database that service providers keep and share on the people they help. By default, personal information is left out of that big database. Homeless individuals have to opt in to sharing it.
To sign a written consent form. So do you give 211 consent to enter your information? Okay.
Homeless service providers say Washington is the only state in the country that does it this way. Everywhere else, the personal data automatically goes into the big federal database unless you specifically say you don't want it to. Here's Mark Putnam testifying in Olympia in February. He's the head of King County's Committee to End Homelessness. It's a coalition of governments, service providers, and advocates for the homeless.
The data provides us with vital information that allows us to improve programs. And improved program performance means we can serve more people and we can serve them more effectively and quicker. And it's so important that we know enough about their situation to be able to serve them well.
It also comes down to money. Keeping thorough data is a federal requirement, and when lots of homeless people decline to let their data be shared, it hurts the state's ability to get federal funding for the homeless. Putnam says it's been costing Washington State nearly $500,000 a year. Funders of homeless services want to use big data to make sure their money's going where it's most needed. But the interest of big funders like the federal government, the Gates Foundation, and the United Way has bumped up against the need for privacy. Grace Huang is with the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence.
I've worked with survivors who have, you know, changed their names and moved across state lines with their children, and their information ended up being sent or shared with their abuser somehow, and they were put in danger and they were forced to pick up and move again.
State officials say Washington's homeless database has never had any security breaches. Huang says when survivors are tracked down by their abusers, they often don't know how they were found out. She says Washington's system is aimed at making sure the big push for data doesn't endanger anyone in the already desperate situation of not having a home.
There's a lot of pressure to, you know, do what you need to do to get into having a roof over your head. And so I know that the providers themselves face a lot of pressure from their funders to have a pretty high compliance rate with collecting that data from people.
I got pulled into my boss's office one day and said, this needs to change, because we were getting a lot of individuals that were opting to have none of their information put into the system.
Eddie Mahon works at the Aloha Inn on Seattle's Highway 99. Part of his job is screening homeless people hoping to live there. Mahon used to be homeless himself. He says he never pressures people into letting their data be shared. Here's what he tells people applying for a room at the Aloha.
For us to keep the best type of funding possible, we would prefer people choosing one of the first two options.
That's either sharing all their personal information or just their name and the last four digits of their Social Security number.
But the choice is completely up to you, and it does not affect your entry into our program.
When Mahon was trying to get a room at the Aloha, he was in the early stages of recovering from a longstanding meth addiction. He says his memories of that time are still fuzzy.
And do you happen to remember if you opted into sharing your data?
I probably did. When I was using, I did really didn't care too much about my information. My credit was so bad that it's like if somebody's really going to go take and use my information, they'd probably improve my credit. So I'm 99% sure that I gave full consent.
Mahon says the Aloha Inn keeps any domestic violence victims' personal information out of the database, but there's no statewide policy along those lines. Advocates for the homeless and for domestic violence survivors had been in a stalemate for about 5 years over how to protect homeless people's privacy. Then in January, their negotiations reached a breakthrough. Homeless advocates agreed to boost privacy protections and training for people like Eddie Mahon to make sure homeless people can make well-informed choices on how their data will be used. The Domestic Violence Coalition agreed to drop their opposition to the push for more data. Grace Huang says the domestic violence community is divided on the bill, but they're not fighting it anymore.
You know, our goal is that people don't feel like they're going to put themselves at risk because they are so desperate to get housing.
Homeless advocates hope to get legislation through Olympia this year and get a bump up in federal funding for the homeless in Washington State. I'm John Ryan reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, Susan Lechband has served on the Hanford Advisory Board for 19 years. The board develops advice for the federal government on cleanup of the nuclear site in southeast Washington, including the removal of contaminated soil and groundwater near the Columbia River.
I think of how beautiful that river is and how vital it is to the city of Richland and Portland and everything downstream.
Anna King talks with Lechband about the long-running cleanup saga. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Areas of morning fog, then partly sunny today. A 20% chance of showers this morning. High temperatures around 60 with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy. Light winds becoming northeast 5 to 10 miles per hour after midnight. Overnight lows tonight in the mid-40s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says partly sunny today and tomorrow, but we can expect some mid and high clouds to start moving in tomorrow ahead of the next rainmaker in the form of an atmospheric river event for the Pacific Northwest. This spells rain moving in later tomorrow night, all day Saturday, and during the day on Sunday. It will likely turn more showery Sunday night and then even more scattered on Monday and Tuesday. Highs 55 to 60, lows in the low 40s. And now we're going to Southeast Washington to bring you the first story in a new series we're calling Daughters of Hanford. It features women who are changing our nuclear legacy at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. It is one of the most contaminated sites on Earth. Susan Lechband is using her natural curiosity to help clean it up. Correspondent Anna King explains.
Susan Lechband's mother and father were not amused. But Lechband says as a girl, she just had to call the Frito-Lay company. Their number was clear, right on the back of the crinkly package, and she was curious.
I asked a lot of questions, and when I was a kid, I got in a lot of trouble making long-distance phone calls. It cost a lot of money in those days to make long-distance phone calls.
Back when she was about 8, Lechband had questions about Tasty Fritos. Now at 67, she's into nuclear waste.
Whenever you say limited data is collected, I'm a little concerned. Your second bullet there.
We're at a Hanford Advisory Board meeting. She's asking if cleanup on a 75-mile area is checked on schedule.
Does it really happen on a 5-year cycle?
It does now.
Partly because people like Lechband ask the question. Lechband has served on the Hanford Advisory Board for 19 years. For most of that time, she also worked at Hanford. She remembers clearly the day her love of the area and her passion for cleanup set fast. About a year before she joined the advisory board, there was a series of events honoring nuclear site workers for Hanford's 50th anniversary. One night, she volunteered at a dinner modeled after what workers used to eat, with Hanford menus and even World War II music.
And I was fortunate enough to meet some of the original workers.
It was talking to those Hanford workers that changed everything.
And I was so inspired by them.
Because of what she learned about their lives and how hard it was in the 40s and 50s to pick up, move to Southeast Washington, and work on a top secret nuclear project.
It brought me to tears as I was serving them food and talking with them about why they came out here from all over the country and lived in conditions that most of us would even not do if we were camping, frankly, because they loved their country.
After that night, Lechband was compelled to throw her shoulder into cleaning up the site. And in her time on the Hanford Advisory Board, she's watched tremendous amounts of cleanup happen near the Columbia River. More than 100 old buildings demolished, contaminated soil moved away, and even contaminated groundwater pumped and treated. We sat near the Columbia River shore for this interview.
And I think of how beautiful that river is, and how vital it is to the city of Richland and Portland and everything downstream.
She has one major regret. There's a concrete and steel pool a stone's throw from the Columbia River. Radioactive fuel rods were left there with water to shield them, but since they were never moved, they broke apart into a radioactive, sludgy mess.
The length of time it has taken, and still is taking, to get that waste away from the proximity of the river, that has been disheartening to me, that it's taken so long.
Lekban's dream for the Columbia is for her children and grandchildren to be able to ride their bikes along this great river shore, past old reactors and sagebrush. That the fences and armed guard there now would be a thing of the past. She's not giving up.
And my family looks at this river and cares about it, and it matters. It's personal to me.
And that's what makes her a daughter of Hanford. I'm Anna King in Richland.
At least a rudimentary ability to use the internet is rapidly becoming a necessary life skill. For small business owners and operators, a web presence is a primary way customers seek details and contact information. For some, the website is also the virtual storefront. For those who came of age before the internet was part of the educational process, the prospect of building a website can seem a daunting one. Tillamook Bay Community College is offering a class intended to change that notion.
With me this morning is Misty Lambrecht. She is affiliated with the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network and Oregon Coast Community College, and she's going to be offering a program on how to build your own website. Now, Misty, why is this a skill that people need now?
I think the biggest part of having your own website and being able to manage and maintain your own website comes down to cost. There's a lot of opportunity out there, and websites several years ago cost huge amounts of money and they were hard to get. And now they're so cost effective that anybody can be on the web. And it gives people a platform so you can say, hey, go to my website and read about me or learn about me or read my resume or buy things from me at the point of sale that's affordable for everyone now.
And not only that, but it seems that if one's applying for a job or wants to distribute what they do, perhaps they're an artist, that people expect to find their information on the web and expect it to be presented in a user-friendly way.
Yes, and this is a platform where they can add samples of their work or testimonials from other people that they've worked for. And those are things that I think employers are looking for and customers are looking for. Is this a legitimate company? Do I want to work with them?
With people who are going to be taking your class, what level of expertise do they need to bring with them?
They just need basic computer skills. If they've used a basic Microsoft Word in the past, so they have some basic typing skills and basic just computer skills, they'll be fine. The reason we use WordPress is because it's extremely user-friendly, and pretty much anybody who knows how to use a basic word processor should be able to conquer this task.
This course takes place over 4 weeks, but that involves 4 entire day sessions. Is there homework?
No, they should be able to build it in class, assuming they have content to bring with them. So they've actually taken the pictures that they want to put on their website. They've actually thought about and pre-planned, I want to have a home page, and then I want to have an about page, and I want to have my services page. And they start to think about what content they would put on those pages. So that's basically the only outside of classroom work that they would need to do. They bring those in on a flash drive, and the actual building mostly happens in class.
Who primarily is the class aimed at?
Same to small business owners, people who don't have a website, but it's not only people who don't have a website. Some of these people already have a website, but it's maybe was built a long time ago, and they just want to convert it to WordPress where they can manage it better. So we take both the new, never had a website, the people who already have a website, and then we also take people who maybe have a shopping cart, maybe they're an Etsy seller or something like that, but want to have their own point of sale on their own website. We'll help those people too. That's really who it's aimed at.
How long have you been teaching this?
About 3 years.
And have you seen an evolution in the kind of the people who took it 3 years ago and the people who are signing up now?
I have a really high success rate of people actually building a site in the class and then being able to maintain and take care of the site long term. So you know, I've go back and look at people's websites that came to my class 3 years ago, and their sites are still up and running and operating. They're still able to do it. It's something they can keep long-term. It's not a short-term project.
Have you had feedback from any of your past students?
Yeah, I have. I have quite a few testimonials of students who have taken the class that didn't sell online before. Part of the class includes a search engine optimization portion. So I have people who have a website before that they never could find, that wasn't searchable, and then they've come into the class, they've done some upgrades, they've changed it, and made a searchable website.
The class takes place over 4 separate days. Are there 4 separate components, and would you want to make sure you took all the classes, or could you take an individual class?
You cannot take an individual class. You do need to come. The first class is probably the most important class. It's deciding you know, what your layout is, what pages you're going to have, making a what I call a shopping list of what you need to bring for the next class down the road. The second class really entails a lot about the logistics of making it look the way you want it to. And then the third class is also a really, really important class. That's the class where we talk about the search engine optimization, how to make the site searchable so that people can use it with Google. The last class is actually a launching our website class. And I do have people who maybe don't come to that for a variety. Their website's done at the end of 3 weeks and they go ahead and launch it, or they're not quite ready. Maybe they're not in business yet, so maybe they don't come to the last class just because they're not really ready to launch it. We give them a flash drive and then they can carry on from there. So if they're going to miss a class, it's generally the last class they miss, but it's not the first three.
And is there anything that you wanted to add?
Basically, don't be afraid to take this class. I've taught this class to a wide variety of people with a wide variety of skills. We have a very high success rate of you can do it. It's a class that anybody can do.
Well, Misty Lambrecht, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
I'm excited to be there. It's going to be a really fun class.
That was instructor Misty Lambrecht. The Build Your Own Website class will take place over 4 Fridays in April, from the 3rd through the 24th. Tillamook Bay Community College asks that participants register with Student Services by March 27th. And that is all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.